Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today, we're going to be talking about a new look at the death penalty. Very interesting article by Walter Burns, who's a professor at Georgetown University. He's really looking at the link between the death penalty and belief in God. And in fact, he's looking at it, you might say, from the other way around. What happens when people no longer believe in God with relation to the death penalty? Right now, Europe is a very fascinating laboratory for answering that question. Walter Burns, writing in the Weekly Standard, suggests that the death penalty is disappearing where secularism takes hold. And he's suggesting that there's a good reason for that, or at least a very understandable reason for that, has to do with the fact that as people lose belief in God, they lose also confidence in moral judgment, especially judgment about something related to the punishment of those charged with what had been capital crimes. The death penalty and belief in God. I posted an article at my website overnight entitled God, Moral Judgment, and the Death Penalty, because not only do I think that Walter Burns is onto something here, I think it has a lot to do with the issues beyond the death penalty. I think it has to do with the way we look at crime, the way we look at punishment, even the way we look at parental discipline. We'll be talking about that in just a moment. I want to invite you to join the conversation. To join us, just call 877-893-8255. Call us at 877-893-TALK. And for this week and next, the first two callers that get on air will be getting a free copy of my book, Culture Shift, Engaging Current Issues with Timeless Truth. I was glad to see a review of it in USA Today in today's edition. That was nice. And we'll be getting to your calls in just a moment. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, a review of some issues in the news. It's interesting to note that the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy turns 15 this week. That was the policy that was rolled out 15 years ago by President Bill Clinton. It was a compromise. What he wanted to do was to remove all barriers to openly homosexual persons serving in the U.S. military. But because of opposition from the military and in the Congress, what he ended up with was a policy that has been lampooned, criticized, and often described as Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Now, while, as Time Magazine reports, the move was initially hailed as progress for the rights of gays in the military, today most homosexual groups have as a central object and goal to get rid of this policy. Let me just read to you from the Time Magazine article by Mark Thompson. He writes, while the phrase don't ask, don't tell wasn't used at the January 29, 1993 press conference, that's what everyone soon began calling the policy. It boiled down to this. The government would no longer ask recruits if they were gay, and so long as military personnel didn't tell anyone of their sexual preference and didn't engage in homosexual acts, they were free to serve. But by the end of 1993, opponents of the change, led by Georgia Democrat Sam Nunn, who chaired the Senate Armed Services Committee, succeeded in writing into law the ban on openly gay men and lesbians in uniform. Now, all of this is also just a reminder of the power of the presidency. Just rewind back to January 29, 1993, Bill Clinton was in his first week in the White House. And this policy, put into effect by executive order, is another reminder of the executive power of the presidency. It is unparalleled in our constitutional order. Time Magazine is also writing today about what it calls the Britney Spears economy. This is really fascinating as well. It turns out that when you start thinking of the media these days, a lot of it's in trouble. When you talk about serious news reporting, you talk about hour-long documentaries, you're talking about Americans who seem to have less and less time for serious news. What do they have time for? Celebrity watching. And I think this is really a very revealing factor in terms of America's psyche. I'm reading here from Jeffrey Herron's article from the Associated Press. He writes, in the days after the Britney Spears soap opera rode a police-escorted gurney into its apex, celeb mag sales spiked, traffic-jammed gossip websites, tabloid TV ratings rose, and paparazzi photo prices surged. For a growing number of people and businesses, Britney's saga is about money. Every time she sinks to new lows, cash flows, and these days, no one is above the fray. Now, here are a couple of things you might want to keep in mind. When you're thinking about this country, and when you're thinking about engaging this culture, realize that one of the fastest-growing segments in the media, certainly both in terms of circulation and interest, as well as money, is the entire celebrity media conglomerate. You have celebrity gossip magazines such as Star, US Weekly, that's Us Weekly, and In Touch Weekly. They're growing, and they helped overall newsstand sales for magazine edge 1% upward to $2.39 billion in the first half of 2007. Now, this absolutely fascinated me. You have a magazine known as OK. Its masthead from Britain is OK with an exclamation mark. It has a 10-person team in Los Angeles devoted to Britney Spears coverage. 10 people. Here is a magazine in Great Britain that has 10 people working full-time in Los Angeles on what the magazine calls a constant Britney alert. Us Weekly has been just as enamored of the star, according to the Associated Press, putting Spears on nearly two-thirds of its covers last year, including each of the last 14. People Magazine has had Spears on the cover 10 times in the past 15 months. Well, you can look at this from so many different directions. You can look at this as capitalizing on a human being's problems. You can look at this as the celebrity focus, almost celebrity worship. But I just have to wonder, why do people think these lies are so interesting? You know, Daniel Boorstin, the late man who was an author and also America's Librarian of Congress, wrote a book in which he talked about pseudo-events and pseudo-celebrity. And he pointed out the fact that certain people in America now are simply famous for being simply famous. There's no particular reason why they're famous, but fame itself is its own industry. Fame itself turns out to be its own dynamic. And certainly when you start looking at the media these days, you don't have to be very perceptive to note that it looks like this kind of celebrity culture is taking over. And that doesn't say very good things about us. Speaking of not saying very good things about us, at the College of William and Mary, President Gene Nickel, according to the Daily Press there, has given students the go-ahead to hold the controversial Sex Workers Art Show on campus next month. Now, this is really very interesting. You have a sex workers art show. Now, what in the world might that be? First of all, for those of you who are not familiar with the term, sex worker refers primarily to people such as prostitutes and strippers. And this is at the College of William and Mary, one of the most venerable academic institutions in the United States, a college established by British royalty within the colony of Virginia, now a part of the state university system there in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Listen to this. In a statement, the college's president said he tried to work with students to hold the event at a venue off the Williamsburg campus. Students were unable to find an off-campus venue, however, and Nickel said the First Amendment and, quote, defining traditions of openness that sustain universities required he permit the show to be held at the college. Now, this is an example of the meltdown of all kind of moral common sense on America's college and university campuses. Here you have a college president, university president, who is allowing a sex workers art show to be gone, to go on his campus because he says that he's obligated to by defining traditions of openness. Openness to what? Listen to this. I'm reading to you directly from the Newport News, Virginia Daily Press. The sex workers art show features performances and monologues by strippers, prostitutes, and other sex workers with its goal being to, quote, now listen to this carefully, dispel the myth that the performers are anything short of artists, innovators, and geniuses. End quote. You see, it's all about art. If you believe that, you're a part of the problem. It is horrifying to think that this is now taking place on an American college campus as venerable as the College of William and Mary, because the president says that the university's defining traditions of openness mean that he has to permit the show to be held at the college. He says this, my views and the views of others in the community about the worth or offensiveness of the program can provide no basis for censoring it, end quote. Well, what would happen if you had, say, a neo-Nazi group that wanted to have an art display on the campus, you know, or an openly racist group or whatever? In other words, no one is completely tolerant. And let's be clear, no one should be. Those things should not happen. But it is really intellectually dishonest to hide behind this idea that that just because something is offensive, it can provide no basis for censoring it. No basis for censoring it? This? Well, then what? Censoring anything? Nothing? You see, this is the kind of thing that really falls in on itself in the entire culture of political correctness. They really don't mean what they say. This is blatant intellectual dishonesty. It's a cave-in to political correctness. It's the celebration of sex workers, which is itself a term which is a euphemism, who want to display themselves as artists, innovators, and geniuses. Well, let's put it this way. They were smart enough to pull it off on the College of William and Mary. That's a genius of sorts, I guess. Back to talk about what happens when belief in God recedes in relation to an issue of such importance as the death penalty. To join the discussion, call us at 877-893-8255. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The 20th century saw so many moral transformations, but one of them has to do with the entire way we look at the punishment of crime and criminals. And this has to do with everything from the sentences for crimes, the whole idea of victimless crimes, especially the death penalty becomes a clear focus because so many are now crusading against the death penalty. And there are different ways to go at the death penalty. There is the accusation that the death penalty needs to be fixed. That's a very interesting discussion, and by the way, I think a very valid discussion. There are things about the application of the death penalty in this country that I think are gravely worrisome and very morally significant. But the program today is really about the whole idea of the death penalty in general. And with the fact that in Europe you have now almost no country that has any form of the death penalty, Walter Burns is a professor emeritus of government at Georgetown University in Washington. He argues that support of the death penalty is tied to belief in God. You see, this is an angle I had not seen treated before. It makes sense. As soon as you start to read his hypothesis, it makes sense. It starts to connect some dots that what he's arguing here would make sense, that declining belief in God would mean also a declining confidence in moral judgment that would lead to something like the death penalty. He documents the link between secularization and declining support for capital punishment. His article was entitled Religion and the Death Penalty, published in this week's edition of the Weekly Standard. Professor Burns begins by observing that the best case for the death penalty, in his words, was made paradoxically by one of the most famous of its opponents, Albert Camus, the French novelist. Indeed, in opposing the death penalty, Camus seems to have grasped what others had missed. Let me read to you from Professor Burns' article. This is what he writes. The death penalty, he said, this is Camus, can be legitimized only by a truth or a principle that is superior to man, or, as he then made clearer, it may rightly be imposed only by a religious society or community, specifically one that believes in eternal life. Only in such a place can it be said that the death sentence provides the guilty person with the opportunity and reminds him of the reason to make amends, thus to prepare himself for the final judgment which will be made in the world to come. For this reason, he said, the Catholic Church has always accepted the necessity of the death penalty. This may no longer be the case, and it may no longer be the case that death is, as Camus said it has always been, a religious penalty. But it can be said that the death penalty is more likely to be imposed by a religious people. Now, I'm going to read to you a little bit more from Professor Burns' article just to flesh this out. He writes, the reasons for this are not obvious. It may be that the religious know what evil is, or at least that it is, and unlike the irreligious, are not so ready to believe that evil can be explained, and therefore excused by a history of child abuse, or say, a post-traumatic stress disorder, or a temporal lobe seizure, all those things in quotation marks, because those are contemporary kinds of pleas and arguments that have been made to mitigate guilt in criminal contexts. From Professor Burns again, he writes, or again, unlike the irreligious, and probably without having to read so much as a word of his argument, they may be morally disposed or better predisposed to agree with the philosopher Immanuel Kant, that the greatest of the moralists, who said that it was, quote, a categorical imperative that a convicted murderer must die. Or perhaps the religious are simply quicker to anger and, while instructed to do otherwise, slower, even unwilling to forgive. In a word, they are more likely to demand that justice be done. Whatever the reason, there surely is a connection between the death penalty and religious belief. Well, I appreciate Professor Burns' honesty that he doesn't know exactly what the link means, but the link does exist. And I want to spill out his argument a little bit and suggest to you that I think the argument is not only right, I think it's bigger than he indicates in this article. And let me just kind of flesh that out for you for a moment. Just test this theory with me. Let's assume that you believe in God. And because you believe in God, you believe in the necessity of moral judgment. Because God is a holy God who has set down his law and has established authority and says that a part of our human responsibility is to punish the evildoer. Now, if you believe in that God, if you are a churchgoer who worships that God, then you're going to believe that one of society's most important responsibilities is to make the right moral judgments. And not only that, you're going to believe that to fail to make the right moral judgment is to dishonor God and is to put society at risk. Put bluntly, this means that when you have someone like a murderer, clearly convicted and without doubt guilty of his crime, someone who's committed volitional, willful homicide, what we in this country typically call as first-degree murder, to allow that person to continue to live would be an insult to the entire citizenry and would put morally at risk the entire population, if not physically at risk. You see, I think that makes a great deal of sense. And when you no longer believe in that God, and one of the things that Professor Burns documents is that church-going rates have fallen in Europe 4% roughly in Germany, weekly attendance in church, 3 and 2% in other countries, 1% perhaps in the Netherlands. You're looking at extremely low rates of participation, church-going and all the rest. I think Walter Burns is onto something here. As I say, I think it's bigger than the death penalty. I think this has to do also with parents and children. I think when parents no longer believe in God, and no longer have a meaningful belief in God is holy, and have no longer a meaningful belief in the structures of authority that God put into place, they also buy into the mentality that children are not so responsible for their wrongdoing, misbehavior, even disobedience. And so you have a lack of effect and cause. You have a lack of punishment. You have parents who believe that their children are victims rather than children who misbehaved and need the consequences and punishment for their misbehavior. I think it's very, very interesting to put all this together. I think Walter Burns is really onto something. I think the inevitable consequences of secularism include the fact that society loses its understanding of objective moral value and loses its confidence in punishing persons who are guilty of even the most grievous crimes. I'd love to know what you think about this. And especially with the death penalty, I guarantee you becoming a contemporary issue of debate here. You have the state of New Jersey just recently deciding to take the death penalty off the books. By the way, a similar proposal in Maryland seems to have gone flat. But across the country, this is being debated in terms of our own understanding in the United States of the death penalty. Now, Walter Burns points out that Europeans make the connection between high rates of church going in America and support for the death penalty. What do you think? The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let me remind you again, the first two callers to get on the air get a free copy of my book, Culture Shift, Engaging Current Issues with Timeless Truth, that provided by the publisher, Multnomah Books. Okay, let's get to the calls, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. At my website, I did post the article entitled God, Moral Judgment, and the Death Penalty. And I did so because I think this is the kind of article that should really make us think, the kind of argument that should bring forth some really quality thinking on the part of Christians. We are called to think through these issues, to think from the basis of a consistent Christian worldview. And without that worldview, I think inevitably we lose confidence in moral judgment. You know, this gets back to the old question, can you have moral convictions? Can you have a moral people when the people no longer believe in God? You see, I think you can, only in the sense that without belief in God, people will negotiate a minimal morality. You know, don't steal from me, I won't steal from you. Don't kill me, I won't kill you. You also have the confusion over morality with all this politically correct stuff. But when it comes to assurance and conviction and moral judgment, I just don't think you're going to have that unless you believe that there really is a God who really will hold us accountable, who really has set down his law, and really does expect that we will honor it. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We've got callers coming from around the world. You could be next on the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to get to your calls as quickly as possible. To Dalton, Georgia, we welcome Andrea, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Andrea.
Yes, I just wanted to say that it's no surprise that we can see a relation between a decline in our civilization and our moral code as a country in relation to seeing our country, and Christians included, getting away from God's law, the original law that he put out there for us.
Now, on something like the death penalty, Andrea, do you think it's necessary for society to have the death penalty, or do you think it's just something that you can, as a society, either choose to have or not to have and still honor the sanctity of human life?
I think that God gave it in the beginning as a necessity, and I think that we aren't any more intelligent than him by any means to be able to say that it's not a necessity.
Yeah, I appreciate your call, Andrea. You know, I think Andrea's pointing to Genesis 9 in particular. We're in the Noahic covenant, right after the flood. As God is setting down terms in this new covenant he is making with Noah, he mentions that when someone takes a human life by choice, he forfeits his own right to life. By man's hand is his blood also to be shed. And that reminds us that this isn't about vengeance. The biblical worldview does not say that capital punishment is justified on the basis of vengeance. You hurt me, I'll hurt you. You hurt mine, I'll hurt yours. It's instead to underline the sanctity of human life in such a way that one who would take it forfeits his own. All right, let's go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. David's also listening on XM170. Go ahead, David.
Hello, Dr. Mohler. I appreciate your show. And I tell you what, as a Christian, I do have a hard time reconciling the death penalty. I believe the death penalty exists simply because we lack the wisdom to find another way to deal with horrible crimes against people.
Okay, help me to factor that out, David. I do appreciate your call. Help me. What would you do with, let's take a serial murderer. What would you do in that case? What would you propose?
He has to have life without parole and try to find a way to make him pay for his, punish him in a way that he could possibly even return some productive, meaningful value to society.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your call, David. And there are Christians who certainly oppose the death penalty, and there are some good arguments to take into account. I'm not persuaded by them, but I think that if I were trying to think of how to answer your suggestion there, I would simply suggest there are some people who take themselves out of the ability to make a contribution to society by the fact that they have been so injurious, murderous, that they have taken human life. I think when we start to take murder with anything less than capital seriousness, we really devalue all human life. That's a good discussion to have, David, and I appreciate your call. I think it's really interesting to track what's going on with death penalty debates in the United States. And I want to, again, help us to clarify intellectually. There are two different debates. One's the debate about whether or not there should ever be a death penalty. And the other debate is about whether or not the way we do the death penalty in this country is legitimate, just, moral, and fair. Those are two different arguments, and both of them are important arguments as well. From Louisville, Kentucky, Phillip's calling, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Phillip.
Dr. Mull, I believe the death penalty is absolutely biblical, and it's just kind of a foreshadow of what Christ did for us. The fact is that we have to pay for our sins. We're held accountable. And Christ came and died to justify God, that he's still holy, and yet he justifies the wicked, and that someone had to die. We have to die for our sins, or someone who is holy and satisfies the law has to die. And that's what Christ did.
You know, very interesting point, Philip. This is a reminder to us that the penalty for sin was death. In a sense, the first capital crime was the very first sin, when Adam and Eve ate of the tree from the fruit that was forbidden them. Ate the fruit from the tree that was forbidden them. And when that happened, we are told that with sin came death. Now, that death was not immediate. It wasn't a guillotine. It wasn't a hanging. It was the death that came with the inevitable result of sin. Every single sin is, from a biblical perspective, worthy of death. You know, when you start looking at that, you realize that when God set down law for us, he made very clear that we don't get what we deserve, even in this life, even with human justice. We don't get what we deserve. But law is put into place as a structure of meaning and morality in order to preserve society, even in the midst of a fallen world. In reality, all of us have done things that deserve the most awful punishment. But when it comes to a code of law, society has to decide those acts that are just completely outside the pale, even some acts that may mean that the perpetrator forfeits his life. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Love to hear from you. We'll be right back with your calls on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The presenting issue is the death penalty. The bigger argument is that as belief in God recedes, so also is confidence in moral judgment very much diminished. The death penalty is the key illustration here. The article is by Walter Burns in this week's edition of the Weekly Standard. Let's go to Seth calling from Orlando, Florida, listening on WHIM. Go ahead, Seth.
Hey, Dr. Mueller. Thanks for taking my call. I had a quick comment. I used to be for the death penalty. I'm not opposed to it still, but I will say my mind has changed a little bit after hearing about stories like the Son of Sam, where people, I think, sincerely, you know, came to Christ and really started doing amazing things.
Yeah, you know, that's a very interesting point, Seth. And I think, you know, when you start thinking about the death penalty or other penalties, it's easy to forget and it's easy to lose focus on the fact that the idea of this jurisprudence structure is not that we judge the hearts of people, but rather that we judge their actions. That's very much a key issue in the law. So in other words, we're not saying this person is good or this person is bad in terms of being able with subtlety to read their hearts. We're saying this action was awful, heinous, criminal, and is to be punished. And that is the reason why traditionally societies have said, we don't care about the disposition of your heart in this case. We care about the crime. What we're punishing is the crime. And obviously, we live in a much more therapeutic age. We live in an age in which we're talking about the very things that you just brought up. As Christians, let's be very, very clear. Our urgency is to see all persons come to faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, with whom we have any kind of opportunity to share witness. And certainly with urgency, those who are on death row, let's hope they hear the gospel. Let's hope they hear and heed and believe the gospel, trust Christ, and are saved. I would tell you, though, that when you think about any other penalty, let's think about a Christian bank robber. If he's sentenced to life for serial bank robbery and then comes to Christ, I don't think people are going to say, well, then let's overlook the bank robbery. I think it goes back to the objectivity of the crime meeting the punishment. It goes all the way back to what Gilbert and Sullivan's work, the Mikado. Let the punishment fit the crime. Let the punishment fit the crime. And yet we are losing confidence in that. Appreciate your call, Seth. It's good to hear from you from Orlando, from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Jerry's calling, listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hello, Dr. Mueller. I could support the death penalty if I believe it was fairly applied and that no person who was convicted might possibly be innocent. But I've read that 86 people convicted since 1976 were taken off the death row and acquitted of any of the crime they were convicted. It just seems like too much of a gamble to take the chance of an innocent person being executed. I just cannot take that gamble and take that risk of somebody who is innocent to be executed.
Yeah, Jerry, I do appreciate the point. I think, again, to divide the question, one question is, would the death penalty itself be moral? Thus, should we have it? Is it necessary, et cetera? The second big question would be, is the application of the death penalty just and righteous and right? I have grave concerns in this country about the application of the death penalty. I think it is racially imbalanced. Very, very clear that a black African-American perpetrator is far more likely to be executed than a white person. It's socioeconomically unjust in this country. If you are wealthy enough to have an outstanding lawyer and a big legal team and all the rest, you're much less likely to be executed for the same crime than someone who is without that. So I share some of your grave concerns. Also, you have the absolute confidence of the conviction here. And that's the issue, Jerry, you really raise. I don't know the number, but let's face it, one or two would be a significant number of persons who would have been convicted of a capital crime and then discovered. Now, by the way, I've been in conversation with some fascinating people on this, including some prosecutors involved in these cases. And one of the things they point out rightly is that the justice system works when, for instance, in an appeals process, evidence is brought forth and someone's taken off a death row. So we should celebrate that. And in other words, that's not a humiliation of the law. That's the law working. But, you know, we are living in a time in which the threshold for the kind of evidence required for conviction ought to be getting higher and higher. We ought to be getting better and better at this. With DNA evidence and other things, we ought not to be receiving the evidence that should not be accepted. We should not be convicting persons, and we should be extremely scrupulous to make sure, not only for the death penalty, but even for any severe penalty or for any conviction at all, we better be certain that we really do have an agreed-upon understanding of what kind of evidence would be required for there to be a consensus of guilt. Now, let's also face the fact with the majority, the vast majority of homicide convictions in this country, and the statistics will bear this out, there is no question about the guilt. Now, there is no evidence out there that that can be adduced to prove otherwise. But you're exactly right. The humility here is that we've got to track that down. I'm not where you are, Jerry, in saying that it can't be done. Because there are just too many cases in which I think the guilt is so very apparent, where you have even eyewitnesses, you have videotape, you have clear DNA evidence, etc. But where you lack the threshold of adequate evidence, and I think you're right to really stretch us on this, then we all obviously have a problem. If you have any number, and I'll just take your number for granted right now, you know, 80-something people who have been convicted of capital crimes, sentenced to be executed, and then evidence has come forth to release them from that death penalty, then obviously there's a grave concern there. Now, I also want to point out, however, Jerry, when you look at that number, and prosecutors have really pointed to this as well, in an awful lot of those cases, it is not necessarily that they were found innocent of the crime, but rather some kind of suspicion was cast upon the evidence or some procedural issue such that they were taken out of the death penalty category. Remember that the death penalty in almost every state, not just for homicide, but for homicide with exacerbating circumstances. So that's something to look at. Obviously, this is a morally complex issue, and every one of the callers has added something to this discussion. And I especially appreciate hearing from those who oppose the death penalty, because I think that's an important voice that needs to be heard. I think when you think about intelligent Christians talking about the death penalty, we got to bring all this to the table. We've got to be accountable for thinking all of these issues through. We also have to be grown-ups and realize that society has to come up with a way of dealing with this. Now, I have to come back to the fact that I believe the biblical logic, a logic that has been accepted in Western law for centuries, is that volitional homicide in particular is really worthy of the death penalty, where the conviction is sound and just, simply because one who takes a human life should forfeit his own. That affirms human dignity and human life. We also have to recognize that throughout the history of Western society, people have been executed for all kinds of lesser things that I think all of us would find now abhorrent. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Mueller Program. Well, get ready for this debate to expand in months and years to come. I can almost guarantee it because, well, for one thing, you got the U.S. Supreme Court taking up some very significant death penalty cases. Could lead to a complete redefinition of the law concerning capital punishment in this country. Certain questions about, for instance, lethal injection, a case being appealed here from the state of Kentucky, another state, Florida, has a significant case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Death penalty is a constant issue and has been, at least in recent decades. Not so much in the past, but in recent decades. The controversy in the past was what crimes, not whether there should be the death penalty, but what crimes should it cover. And you have right now another case before the U.S. Supreme Court having to do with rape, the abuse or rape of a child being a capital crime. Now, all that to say, we as Christians need to be a part of this conversation. But we need to be intelligent and thoughtful when we enter this conversation. We need to be able to divide the question between those two big questions. Number one, should there be a death penalty at all? And secondly, if so, how should it be ordered? If there's a problem, how should it be fixed? Those are two different questions. And obviously, if you don't believe there's a death penalty, that there should be a death penalty, you don't believe there are any crimes worthy of the death penalty, then your goal is not going to be to fix the capital punishment system, but rather to eliminate it. And we have both of those conversations going on in this country right now. Now, when you look at the United States versus Europe, boy, you see a very contrasting picture. Europe, almost no countries that practice capital punishment. In the United States, widespread support for capital punishment. Now, is it diminishing? Well, in a state like New Jersey, it certainly looks like it. But even fairly close by, in a state like Maryland, doesn't look like it. Nationwide, polls indicate, much like on other conflicted questions, that Americans are somewhere in some kind of middle ground. Yes, we believe there should be a death penalty, but most Americans also express some moral concern about the way the death penalty is administered in this country. I want to go back to Walter Byrne's argument and suggest again that I think his argument is not only onto something, I think it's bigger than the question of the death penalty. I think it has to do not only with the punishment of murderers by the state. I think it has to do with the punishment of children by parents. It has to do with holding people accountable in the workplace. You see, we bought into the whole idea that there is no such thing as crime. It's just antisocial behavior. There's no such thing as disobedience. It's just, the expression of the child's independent will. We have all these redefinitions in a therapeutic society. And all of this together, I think, just as Walter Byrne insinuates, really does come from a loss of moral certainty. And I think he's exactly right. That must be tied to declining belief in God, who ultimately is alone the moral certainty. Back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Miller Program. You'll set the agenda. We'll talk about what's on your mind. I'll meet you then for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'm Albert Miller.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.